This podcast features a session from the EDUCAUSE 2011 annual conference. The session is by Marilyn McMillan, Vice President for Information Technology and Chief Information Technology Officer for New York University, and is entitled, Clients Get IT, So Must We.
Thank you for coming to this session. I appreciate so much the opportunity actually to reflect a little bit on leadership in the context of the new directions in which we're all heading. And I have to tell you, I have more questions than answers. But I want to set the stage first to share with you some of the thinking and reading I've been doing and some of the learning along the way. But I am not here with answers. I'm here to raise some questions and hope that as we all go through the sessions of the conference and the aftermath of the conference, we continue to reflect on some of this stuff. So I'm going to talk first a little bit about New York University to give you some context. I arrived at NYU in 1998, so it's way too long ago for me to tell you much of anything about MIT or Stanford, where I was before that. At NYU, I was the first person appointed to the CIO job, and one of the fun things of that was that I really got to invent it, and it hasn't been, I have to tell you, the same job 2 years running, which is cool because there's nothing that energizes me more than learning new stuff and getting new cool things done with really smart, dedicated people. I feel very grateful for my time at NYU and for the team of people with whom I work. I want to talk some about the client perspective on IT today. I want to talk about what I think that implies for those of us who are IT professionals. And then I have reserved a couple of slides for more questions than answers about leadership. So New York University. Founded in 1831 as a private university in and of the city by the merchant class in New York City. The founder, one of the founders, Albert Gallatin, is better known as having been Thomas Jefferson's Secretary of the Treasury and done a bunch of financial stuff. So the background at that time was modeled on the University of London campus, which is very much a city mercantile kind of ethos in contrast to the King's College, Queen's College, and other more church-related institutions that were founded at that time. Today, in 2001, we call ourselves a global network university, and those of us who have the geek translator going all the time thought that meant boxes and wires and ports, but it doesn't. It means the network of scholars who connect with one another in and around the world. We are about 51,000 students, with 12 or so thousand of those being in non-degree programs, 16,000 employees, the largest private university in the United States, if not more broadly. There are 14 schools in 5 major centers in Manhattan for NYU, and we're also affiliated with Polytechnic Institute of New York, which takes us all the way across the East River to Brooklyn. And frankly, the Brooklyn-Manhattan connection has been one of our more complex networking challenges. We have now what we are calling portal campuses, meaning a campus that runs at least a 4-year program, if not some additional graduate and professional programs, where a student can enter as a freshman and get an NYU degree, having completed all their academic work at that program in 2 sites. We opened the NYU Abu Dhabi campus in 2010, and we'll be opening the NYU Shanghai campus in 2012. We have run for almost 50 years global education. We have now global academic centers where students study abroad and faculty go to research in 11 and soon to be 13 cities. You can imagine the perspective from New York City maybe think of that poster, you know, the famous New Yorker poster. We consider Washington, D.C. one of our global sites. So let me tell you a little bit about our Global Network University, which we fondly refer to as GNU, not GNU, GNU, IT strategy, which we've actually been working on in several iterations since about 2007, before we could even say out loud where in the Middle East NYU might be thinking about opening a portal campus. The strategy has three parts that have stayed pretty much intact through this time, but as we've articulated the strategy and moved our way into it, we're now up in operation. We've certainly learned stuff as we've gone. So the first leg of the strategy has been to connect the NYU community through a hybrid network. Up to now, we've reached all of our global academic centers through the commodity internet and by connections through the national research and education networks in those countries. We recognize that in order to support much higher bandwidth demanding applications like voice over IP, video conferencing, we need to have a network that can not only use the commodity internet and get people to all those resources, but also have very good quality of service throughout the NYU global footprint. And we're working on that. You can see, I'm glad you can see this, the picture better than I on my screen here. The second part of the strategy is to connect the NYU community to its content. And broadly speaking, that content, which includes applications and actual media and all of the other electronic and digitized materials you can imagine, we tend to think of as clumping into four big tranches: teaching and learning, research, university life, which includes student life and faculty life, and every once in a while, consideration of staff life, and administration, the administrative services that support and underpin the university business around the world. Our goal in these two elements of the strategy is to promote the mobility of everyone and anyone in the community, and to tap what our president, John Sexton, would call the global talent flow of students and scholars, so that if you happen to be primarily located in New York as a student and you choose to take a semester somewhere else, your academic profile travels with you. And you have no problem staying connected back with your colleagues in New York for whatever you need to. And similarly for faculty and other researchers, that you can take a semester if you're a faculty member in Abu Dhabi and come to New York City and still be able to pursue your research interests in Abu Dhabi at the same time being closely engaged with faculty either in New York or somewhere else. In fact, one of our other innovations as a part of this global network strategy is that NYU New York becomes a global study away site for those students who are based in our portal campuses in other parts of the world. The third leg of the strategy is connectivity to Sun Never Sets services, so that wherever you are, at whatever time you're awake, if you need assistance with IT or you need access to whatever service you're using, the service is up and running and the people who can help you use it are available to assist you if you need it. This is a really tall order. Now, we thought, I think, when we first designed 1, 2, 3, that this would be sort of sequential. You know, we'd get 1 done, and then we move on to 2, and then, you know, 5 years as a part of the 5-year plan, we'd have 3 ready to go. Well, guess what? We're in multitask mode from the day we installed the first switch in Abu Dhabi, and we are involved now in working all 3 parts of the strategy. And we are learning, of course, from all 3 parts of the strategy. reflect back on each other. We keep portfolio reports and progress reports, a fair amount of metrics, and I'm happy to talk in more detail about that, but that's not really the purpose of my talk, so I'm moving on. Now, one of the big features of this service around the clock strategy is to get much more conscientious and adept at IT service management. This picture, taken from an ITIL chart, gives you some idea of what the client, who expects availability of the service all the time, ubiquity of the service, and mobility of the service to move with you wherever you may be, to be available all the time, depicts what the thinking is of clients, and these are some of our NYU clients, to figure out whether what I need exists, how do I get access to the service, it works, I know what's new or changed when a new release comes out, I know how to ask for it, I know when to expect to get it, I can report a problem and get it fixed, and I know how it works over time. And of course, for all of us in the room, you know that just the answer to just those questions reflects a whole bunch of process improvement and process maturity and process integration across our IT organizations. And that's something at NYU in which we're deeply involved right now. And we're involved not only at the IT service level, but at the layer of the function, the functional offices who support services as well. It's requiring us to think and operate in very new ways. And I'm not going to talk any more about that either. What I do want to talk about is clients. And, you know, we've had lots of different paradigms for thinking about our clients and how they use IT and what they might be expecting to do with IT. One of the famous ones that I tend to check every year is the Beloit College Mindset List. And this is copyright, as you can see down the bottom, from Beloit. And I don't have permission to publish it. I have permission to flash it today for you. But I recommend you take a look at their site because they actually build on all the other lists they've ever done since the 1990s. And as a matter of fact, they've published a book and they can tell you what the mindset was of the class of 1880, in case you're interested. So here are some. There are 50 or so characteristics that they give for each year. And here are some for this current class. There's always been an internet ramp on the information highway. They swipe cards, not merchandise. As they've grown up on websites and cell phones, adult experts have constantly fretted about their alleged deficits of empathy and concentration. Their school's blackboards have always been getting smarter. Excuse me. Don't touch that dial, what dial? Video games have always had ratings. Dial-up is so last century. Music has always been available as free downloads. They pressured their parents to take them to Burger King or elsewhere to get free pogs. They've broken up with significant others via texting, Facebook, MySpace. They won't go near a retailer that lacks a website. They've always had the privilege of talking with a chatterbot. Now, you know, you may think this is only about the entering freshman class, but in fact, when you think about it, particularly this situation, as we all heard this morning from Seth, adult experts have constantly fretted about our alleged deficits of empathy. We spend too much time checking what's normal, and concentration. It's really hard not to look at the phone. And so that actually led me to thinking about another way of characterizing clients, and I was glad to find that someone had done some of that work. First, before we get there. So here's one of the experts, and actually, Sherry Terkel, and I started at MIT in about the same, within the same 6 months. And she was describing a retreat that she attended. This is from her new book, Alone Together. During my earliest days at MIT, I met the idea that part of my job would be to think of ways to keep technology busy. And this was true in a retreat that she did with some of the leading computer scientists at the time, including Mike Dertouzos, who was the director of MIT's Lab for Computer Science, and Seymour Papert. Now, she says, we know that once computers connected us with each other, once we became tethered to the network, we really didn't need to keep computers busy. They keep us busy. It is as though we have become their killer apps. An interesting, you know, twist, all right? So then thinking about this issue of 24-hour service and 24-hour customer, I was actually pleased wandering into my local public library at the Cape this summer to find this book by Adrian Ott called The 24-Hour Customer. And I thought, oh, cool. This has the roadmap for service delivery in an environment in which the sun never sets. But no, that's not where she went with this. She talked about a 2x2 matrix. Adrian is a strategist in Silicon Valley for firms that design products and services. She said you can look at life from the point of view of propensity to spend time with online services, as well as from the point of view of propensity to allocate your attention to the time and the services. And in her scheme, you get a four-box matrix. What a surprise. And she said, regardless of age, what we're really looking at is a new habituated customer who, in some senses, we've created by the technologies and the offerings that we've made. And when you think about the way you position your services, and when you think about your response to your clients, you need to think about them in these contexts, because the really important thing is the trade-off decision that people make between the value to them of a service and the cost in time that it takes them to get access to it. And so up in this high attention, high amount of time spent quadrant, she says these are the applications that are related to what people really care about. And she asserts they care about peers, connecting with other people, power, greed in some cases, making money, and personal pursuits like self-improvement, like education. In the habit quadrant, where people spend time but not give a whole lot of attention, she talks about routines people follow, sort of mindlessly, but you do it every month. Or even better, background processes that you've subscribed to that get renewed without your having to spend any time at all. In the value quadrant is the example of what Seth showed us this morning, all the products and all I care about is get me the cheapest one, don't take any of my time. And the advice that she gives to those of us in higher ed is, if you've got a product or a service in the value quadrant, meaning the cheap price quadrant, don't invest a lot of cost in it either, because you're not going to recoup the cost you invest in a product that's at the commodity cheap end. The convenience quadrant is actually designed for me. Not the first part. The productivity enhancers are things where you would allocate more of your attention but not too much time to get stuff done. Procrastinator catch-ups. That's me. And so services like FedEx, you know, where you can mail the thing this morning and get it there tomorrow, and you're willing to pay a little extra to actually get it there, fall in the category of the convenience quadrant. There are, in Ott's book, a number of very interesting ways to characterize the old rules we used to play by in product design and product pricing, the new rules we need to think about playing by if we're going to succeed in addressing the needs of all our 24-hour customers. And I don't want to talk about that either today. But it's an interesting context that we're already starting to think about at NYU. I think as I read this, what I also saw in the so must we category is that we IT professionals live in this same space. And the tools we use to get our stuff done falls in some of these same categories. So one of the cautions that Ott gives, for example, is don't give me an application that requires me to spend a lot of my time and my attention on it if it's not in the quadrant that is where I'm motivated to be. Design whatever you're going to do that you want me to do that isn't my motivation quadrant to fit in one of these other categories. Make it easy. Make it habitual. Make it something I can do at the very last minute and still give you a result while I spend my time in the motivation quadrant doing the stuff that's not only important to me but also presumably important to the rest of the organization. So an example from our life at NYU, we had in the olden days any number of ways in which to do project status reporting and project management. Now with our global network university set of projects alongside the sets of projects that we were already doing in New York for the New York campus, we needed a way to bring together the information about portfolios of projects really easily without over-consuming the time or attention of the project managers, because after all, the project manager's job is actually to get the project done, not to spend time in overdrive. So we needed to find a convenient and, in fact, cheap on the expense of their time way to report regularly so that we could roll up reports so that those of us in leadership roles could have the same report for this committee or for that committee or the other committee and any project that might fall in multiple portfolios, such as email migration, for example, only needed to be reported on once every month. And everybody understood the same vocabulary for what green, yellow, and red meant, and everybody was looking at the same report that said the same status. That was a big change, and we've been able, with a lot of muscle building on everybody's part, to pull that off and make that happen. Makes us at NYU earn the creds to be a very credible partner with the academic and business sides of the house in terms of being good shepherds of the university's resources going forward. So that led me to think about, for the 24-hour IT professional, where do we put our motivations, particularly when we're in the middle of a revolution, as Seth described it earlier today. And that led me back to a paradigm that I discovered as a part of my service here at EDUCAUSE on the faculty of the Director Institute back when we formed it in the mid-90s, early to mid-90s. The paradigm was about motivation and mastery of tasks. If you think about now in the bottom quadrant, the level of skill or experience running from low to high at a given thing. And on the vertical axis, the degree of complexity of the particular thing. This is all the work, it's going to show up at the bottom one of these times, of Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, who has written a lot and studied a lot, a psychologist who studied a lot about creativity, mastery, and what he calls flow as the engine that keeps us engaged in things that motivate us. So the example Csikszentmihalyi gives is a tennis match. When you're playing against a partner who's roughly at your same skill, it's enjoyable. When you're playing against a partner whose skill is lower than yours, whose skill is higher than yours, the degree of complexity exceeds what you're at this point capable of being able to do generally throws us into a state of anxiety. Don't even play at your best elementary game, never mind your very, a sophisticated game. My favorite personal example of this was on the golf course with my husband, who was a star player in high school, golfer in Texas, went on to be part of the golf team at MIT. They actually do, I think, still have a golf team at MIT, got them out of New England at the right time of year. And after we were married, bought me a set of clubs, you know, and I would wander out there on the golf course with him and would not pick up a club. I have a little bit of competitive in my juices. And I knew that when he hit it a ton, I would not. And, when he sank the putt, I would not. And it wasn't until a day when we were following these two other guys, and I noticed the one guy completely whiffed the ball. It was basically still on the tee after he swung. And then his partner really whammed it right into a tree that sent it behind him. And I thought, shit, I can do that. And so I picked up a golf club and found it a really enjoyable experience. And my husband, David, an incredibly patient person. He actually liked having someone to explain the game to. It could have been different when you're a player who has a high level or higher level of skill and experience, and you're playing with someone at the low end of the complexity scale, what generally happens is boredom, and you might even choose to just check out and get out of that game entirely and go play something else. And Mahai's discovery is that when you match the right level of continuing to improve your skill with the right degree of increasing complexity of task, we all can get ourselves into the state of flow where we lose track of time, we get better at what we're doing, and we develop a self-motivating incentive to keep at it. So one of the goals in a continuum of an art or a skill is to be able to create that kind of flow. I mean, if you think of it in your personal life, think of something you're trying to learn and do and fail at and succeed at, and then think about bringing a team to that same level of competence in an increasingly complex world. You see that in, tournament baseball teams and basketball teams as well. Now, in our world today, one of the issues, I think, is that the dimension we've been on and we've been flowing at now is taking a step function in degree of difficulty of what we have to do that is bringing out a lot of anxiety in all of us. And when I look at the kinds of things we're trying to do at NYU with respect to IT professionals being motivated to do our work, we're way beyond the issue of learning the technologies du jour that we need to deliver. We are into learning and improving and integrating service management and service availability in ways we haven't had to do before because services are so much more interdependent on one another than they ever were before. We used to be able to have the disaster recovery plan for administrative systems and the separate disaster recovery plan for academic systems. We can't do that anymore. They depend on each other. We're in a similar state with information integration and security. The whole question that Ott raises of how do you do client-driven service design is one, we just took the book out of the library. We're not even started on the learning curve of that. We're a lot further along at NYU on portfolio and project management, but we're not done. We're also a lot further along on IT governance and communication, and that's another talk for another day, or a little more information on that was in my talk last year here. And a big part of what we're trying to accomplish is performance optimization. Although we are the 24-hour IT professionals, this is now a way of life. We used to think of it as a sprint, but we can't be on doing IT professional stuff, all of us, 24/7. And so we need to find ways to optimize our collective performance, which means a whole lot of change in behavior. So how does leadership come into this? I have some questions. How do we lead out of all these new anxieties into individual and organizational flow when we're at a step function in what are the things we need to, in the complexity, the increased complexity of what we have to deliver and the level of skills and experience that we have to bring to the table? And, you know, to pick up on Seth's talk this morning, we're in the middle of a revolution where bureaucracy is not the answer either. How do we lead in optimizing the 24-hour time value trade-off, that's that OTT matrix I showed you earlier, for clients and for staff? How do we enable and encourage others to lead? It was so fun to be on the podium today with Mac McNichols. It's wonderful to see rising stars and his representation of rising stars throughout our profession. There's a whole bunch of us gray-haired people who may have spent too much time making this job look too hard. It's hard, but it's not us doing it alone. And we need to find ways to make it look not so anxiety-provoking, or for that matter, not so boring, so that we encourage others to jump into the fray of leadership. And by the way, you know, I hope I don't have to tell you, leadership is not positional. You know, if you look at the influence and effectiveness that people in leadership roles have, the fact that they have a title represents about 10% or maybe 20% of the real leadership capacity and authority any one of us has. My own favorite goal is to make sure that everyone feels enabled to exercise leadership skills and ready to be leaderly in whatever their endeavor. So when I think about leadership, I think about first producing results with others and for others. And I used to think, when I first started in a leadership role at MIT, I used to think it was my job to be the advocate for my guys to the hierarchy. And I see much now, it's a much more complex task of the leader to be the 360-degree communicator. And that's available as a role wherever you are in the organization. Alignment of purpose and vision, particularly in this time of upheaving change, is a really important attribute. When Carol Barone won the leadership award some time ago from EDUCAUSE, one of the lessons I took away from her talk and subsequent article was her advice to read the river, that a leader's responsibility is to know the changing nature of the river you're in. And not to assume that because you were in the same river yesterday, the river's the same today. And that requires incredible amount of attention, but it's not Herculean. And having just put my daughter, the rocket scientist, back on the airplane to NASA, I can say it's also not rocket science. It's paying attention. Interdependence is another attribute that leaders not only have to recognize, but foster. None of us is able to do this kind of work by ourselves. And in fact, being able to swap out the leaderliness from the being led in a range of activities is a very important attribute, not only for us as individuals, but also for ways that we get teams working together across borders that looked uncrossable not long ago. Sway, being able to influence and being curious and influenceable, swayable, is a huge part of this role that we all have and that we need to be able to encourage in others. And finally, enthusiasm. This role takes renewing your own energies and uplifting the energies of other people in tough situations, doing really hard work under often duress circumstances. And if you can't find the enthusiasm in the deep purpose that you're working, you need to renew yourself and be able to, to convey that. And I am not always even more than 50% on all these attributes. My amygdala is every bit as active as the ones that that Seth described to us this morning. And it takes restfulness for me to shut the voice on my amygdala and be able to come forward in stressful situations with the leadership style I know I can execute. And it takes all of us that kind of preparation, reflection, to be able to jump in and do the next thing. When I was at MIT, I was on the leadership team led by Jim Bruce, who was MIT's first vice president for information systems. And one of his practices was to run the leadership team rather like a graduate seminar. Jim had been the dean of the School of Engineering. He was a professor of electrical engineering. He had credentials out the wazoo and patents and a doctoral thesis, and I was on his team, and I'm not an engineer. I'm a poli-sci type. I programmed in a number of languages, but I never built a box or designed a circuit. And so when I looked at what it took to be CIO at MIT, I thought to myself, well, good for him. He's the right person. I will never be that. Jim sent each of us in turn out into the wider world to engage on behalf of MIT. And when my turn came, I was sent to a CIO roundtable sponsored by, you'll remember the term, Digital Equipment Corporation. That was back in 1989, and as I sat at the table, I noticed not everyone in the room was an electrical engineer. Not everyone in the room was an MIT professor or wore a brass rat. Certainly none of the others had been deans of the School of Engineering at MIT. And at the end of the day, they gave us a tchotchke that I found this summer when I was thinking about what to talk about. It says, CIO Roundtable. 1989 digital. Now, even if you put a new battery in, the clock doesn't work. But, you know, this was another one of those occasions where I thought, hell, I can do that. And it's that kind of, now, it took me, this is 1989, 1998, took NYU and me a while to be ready for each other and find each other. But when we did, I was ready to begin to understand what were the needs of information technology at NYU. And I'm still learning, and I'm still so lucky to be learning with the group of colleagues that I have in this very exciting endeavor that we're embarked on. I was looking back. My mom was an officer in our PTA back in when I was in elementary school. And as a matter of fact, she stayed in Parent Teacher Association for a long time and ultimately won a Lifetime Achievement Award in PTA. And my sister Pam found among Mom's things, Mom died last winter and we've been going through her things, a booklet from 1955 for PTA officers. And this is one of the things she had marked in her booklet, clearly something she used in a meeting or something somewhere. I remember being the one who helped set up the pyramid of coffee cups, you know, at the refreshment table. So it says, for lack of leadership, information was lost. For the lack of information, inspiration was lost. For the lack of inspiration, action was lost. For the lack of action, the cause was lost, all for the lack of leadership. The end. So I have, oh, great, cool, good timing. I have 5 minutes. I'm happy to do questions, and I will just tell you this is a birthday portrait I took of myself this summer. That would be my toes. I did clip them beforehand. They were clean. And I keep that on my desktop here to remind me of the reflection I do when I'm not in New York. Questions, comments? Cool. Thank you very much. Have a great conference.
You can hear more podcasts by visiting us online at www.educause.edu/podcasts. Thanks for listening.